This talk is a summary talk that gives an overview to the 4 weeks of lectures that cover the nutritional relationships to degenerative diseases. The degenerative diseases are defined as those diseases that are unnatural to man, that never happens to primates in the wild, and that rarely happen to those in the undeveloped nations that don't have the benefits of the high-fat, high-cholesterol diet that we have in the developed nations. These degenerative diseases are called heart disease, diabetes, arthritis, cancer in many forms, gallstones, high blood pressure, glaucoma, cataract, loss of hearing. These are all the degenerative diseases, diseases that are unknown to primates and to man in his natural state. Now, many people have looked for causes for these diseases. They look for viruses, look for toxins, pesticides, stress, heredity. However, we're going to find, and we're finding every day in scientific experiments, that the causes of these degenerative diseases, and these incidentally are the principal cause of death in the developed nations, that the cause of these diseases are from the ordinary foods that we eat. They're the ordinary foods that we're taught to love by our parents, and they're the foods that I consider indispensable to a good nutritional diet by the nutritionists that advise people in our country and countries like ours. Ordinary foods in excess can become poisonous to the body. Water, iron, these are all substances we consider absolutely indispensable. Iron is part of the red blood cell. Without the red blood cell, you would be dead. And yet the iron comprises 5% of the total weight of a red blood cell. Yet in Africa, in Bantu country, 10 million Bantus, use iron pots to cook their food. And the iron rusts a little bit. And the little bit of rust then gets into their food. And in a period of time, the iron overloads the liver. And the principal cause of death then is iron overloading of the liver. The iron just fills the liver to such an extent it's just like an alcoholic who has cirrhosis of the liver and dies from that cause. Iron overloading the liver. So too much iron and too much of other things can create poisonings to the body. The principal toxic factors in the developed nations' diet that creates their degenerative diseases are simply the fats, the cholesterol, and in a lesser way, the refined foods. We have an additional insult in developed nations, and that is the smoking habit. So you have to ask then, what diet should one be on? And how do you determine the best diet for man? What is the natural diet for man? What's the diet he should be on? If you want to ask what the natural diet for chimpanzees might be, it's very simple. You go into the wilds of Africa, you find chimpanzees that have never been disturbed by man, and observe what they eat, and you'll know what the natural diet is. But you can't find a group of men that have not been affected by civilization. There is no natural diet for man anymore that you can find, so you'll have to guess what it could have been. And our guess is that the natural diet of man had to be a diet where refined foods are not included. And by refined foods, we mean, and these are many of the artificial foods that are not found in nature, the foods that are derived and manufactured. For example, one manufactured food is margarine. Margarine is considered rather an important food in the food supply, yet margarine is a manufactured food made by chemical processes out of various fats and oils. It's called a hydrogenated fat made by chemical methods. Now, butter itself is a manufactured food. Without man taking the milk of an animal, separating the fat out, processing the fat in a certain way to create the butter, you couldn't have it. Oils, vegetable oils, are considered natural foods, but they're not. Without man taking the nut and seed, the corn and so on from which oil is made and processed them by very special ways, you couldn't have oil. For example, it takes 14 ears of corn to make 1 tablespoon of corn oil. Cheeses are man's invention. The dairy products, it's unnatural, for example. There isn't a group in the world that has its milk after it's weaned. Man is an exception. He gets it from other animals and uses their milk as part of a drink. And we have unnatural animals. These are the feedlot animals. These are the animals raised under artificial conditions. There are chickens that are raised that never see the ground. They're in cages all through their lifetime. Animals are fed with hormones to make them grow faster, make them grow heavier. Beef animals have intense marbling in their muscles, between the muscle fibers. In fact, a feedlot animal can have 50% of its total carcass in fat, whereas a range-fed animal only has 9%. So you already have 500% more fat in an artificially grown animal than a natural animal. When you look at foods, people have mistaken ideas because of the pressures of the wrong kind of information, the so-called nutritionalists that run our society and determine our food intake. Potatoes are considered fat, yet potatoes have 1% of their total calories in fat. Bananas are considered fattening, yet they only contain 2% of their total calories in fat. Cheese is considered a high-protein food, yet it contains 70% of its total calories in fat. Nuts are considered a high-protein food, yet they're 75% of the total calories in fat. A good fillet is considered a choice piece of protein. If you get an excellent fillet, it could be 85% total calories in fat. So we have mistaken ideas about what foods are composed of. And if you eat foods that are refined like sugar or fat, neither of which have anything but calories, neither of which have vitamins, minerals, dietary fiber, they're just straight calories, that's the way to gain weight, because sugar and fat can be eaten in great quantities without really being feeling that you have satisfied your hunger. And it's only in countries that eat refined foods where there's such a thing as overweight. What happens when you violate nature's laws and eat the refined foods? We have that in Dr. Swank's works, Dr. Kuo's works, Dr. Friedman's works. Dr. Swank, for example, in his first work on determining what happens to the body when you have cream, high fat in the meal, took little hamsters. And the reason he selected them is because they have large cheek pouches. He pulled open their cheek pouch, clamped it tight, and with a microscope looked at the fine blood vessels that he could see through the transparent skin or membrane of the inside of the mouth. And all the vessels were free-flowing. All the little blood vessels, you can see the little cells going through. Yet when you gave them a glass of heavy cream, within an hour and a half to 2 hours, the little cells started to stick together and form great clumps blocking the vessels. In 5 or 6 hours, probably 25% of all the vessels were blocked in these little hamsters. At the same time, he measured the amount of oxygen in their blood and in their tissues. 1/3 less oxygen is what he measured. He decided not to give them anything more to eat for 72 hours to see when the oxygen level would restore to normal. And it took 72 hours, and they still were 5% less oxygen when they started. Well, they couldn't keep them without food any longer. But in the American diet, where one fat meal follows another every 6 hours, everybody has blocked vessels all the time. When Dr. Kuo, Peter Kuo, a cardiologist in Philadelphia at the time, decided to see if Swank's experiments would work on his angina patients, he invited 14 angina patients to his office, took some blood samples. The blood was reasonably clear, taped them to the electrocardiographic equipment, no coronary insufficiency, and then gave them a glass of heavy cream. And it only took 4 to 5 hours when the fat and the cream poured into the bloodstream to block enough vessels so that he registered 14 cases of angina. The electrocardiogram confirmed the angina. The blood samples had 5 times as much fat as when he started. And when Dr. Williams did his work, he was able to confirm that the small vessels of the eyes that were completely open before the cream drink, after the cream drink, many vessels were closed, just like in the hamster study. And when Dr. Kuo did this test again, a short time later with the same angina patients, he gave them another drink. This time, there was no fat in the drink, just protein and carbohydrates, but the same amount of calories and the same amount of bulk. And this time, 5 hours after the test, the blood had no additional fat in it, the electrocardiograms were all completely normal, and there wasn't a single angina attack. When Dr. Meyer Friedman of the Mount Zion Hospital in San Francisco, he wrote the book on type A and type B personalities. He believes in the stress theory to some extent, but he was concerned about the American Heart Association recommendations that it's all right to eat your natural diet as you eat in this country, but just change the kind of fat that you eat. used polyunsaturates instead of saturated fats. He knew that saturated fats created blockages of the vessels in the body, but he never tested polyunsaturated fats. So he got together about 40 firemen from San Francisco, and after an overnight fast, photographed the fine vessels in their eyes and noted they're all wide open. And if you look at his article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, you'll be able to see the vessels all open. And then he gave them a glass of heavy cream. 5 hours after the cream drink, you could probably see 25 blockages in the eyes of these firemen. And you can see those photographs in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Later on, when he took the same firemen and this time gave them a drink of polyunsaturated fat, which is safflower oil, a very popular polyunsaturated fat, 5 hours after the drink, the blockages were just as severe and just as many as with the butterfat. The difference was that with the butterfat drink, 9 hours after the test, the butterfat had gotten out of the system. But with the safflower oil, 9 hours after the test, the polyunsaturated fat had not yet started to leave the system. We don't know when it got out of the system. He stopped his test in 9 hours. Dr. Friedman was very concerned, and in his summary of his article, said he warns against the idea of substituting polyunsaturates for saturates, especially when both block just as effectively the small vessels in the body. He urged the reduction of all fats. That was 1965. We wonder when the American Heart Association is going to read their own material. It's only been 13 years. If you look at the latest cookbook the American Heart Association has put out just last year, and you look through the recipes, you'll have to wash your hands afterwards because they're filled with corn oil. Every recipe just about has corn oil in it. The American Heart Association doesn't seem to agree with Dr. Friedman. Well, how important is diet in coronary heart disease? And first I should say that heart disease is a bad term because in most cases, unless you've had a heart attack, there's nothing wrong with your heart. Your heart's as good as it was when you were a teenager. The problem is not heart disease. It's artery disease. The little vessels, the coronary vessels that feed your heart, are narrowed. And they're narrowed so much that you begin to have symptoms. The heart muscle is struggling to keep alive. Not enough blood flow, which means not enough oxygen. And that's what heart disease is. Closure of the arteries that feed the heart, like any other muscle would have. So that artery disease is our real problem. And when we talk about diet and heart disease, how important is it? We can only look at the Framingham study. The Framingham study has been going on for almost 30 years now. 5,200 people have been monitored every 2 years with extensive examinations, and all the scientists did was to watch them live, watch them die, watch them get their heart attacks, watch them get diabetes, and so on. They offer them no advice. They just monitor them. And what we find in the Framingham study, if your cholesterol level is 260 or higher, you have 400% greater incidence of coronary events and deaths than if it's 220 or less. It doesn't take a great difference in cholesterol level to create a tremendous excess in coronary deaths. We find this so with many of the studies. But these are studies where we're observing. It'd be interesting to go right to angiographic studies, like the Cleveland Clinic studies. Cleveland Clinic, one of the largest surgical institutions in the country, has been doing angiographic studies, coronary angiograms, x-rays of the inside of the coronary arteries for many, many years. They've done thousands of these. And they have been able, because of their vast experience, make correlations between what they see in the x-ray of the inside of the arteries and other factors. And they feel that cholesterol level seems to be the principal predictive factor for closing your arteries. For example, if your cholesterol level is under 200, they find that only 1 out of 5 of the people who come through their center have significantly closed coronary arteries. But if the cholesterol level is 360 or more, 91% have significant closure. And they find that in every step, as cholesterol level rises, the arteries are more closed. More people have closed arteries. Cleveland Clinic decided that they had so much confidence in their work, they did what we call a double-blind study. That means the original physicians that looked at the data didn't know who the patients were, and the patients didn't know who were doing their tests and so on. 60 men came into Cleveland Clinic, and they had their age, cholesterol levels, and triglyceride levels taken. A group of physicians that never had to see the patients took these three numbers, cholesterol level, age, and triglycerides. The age was important because that tells us how long the cholesterol has been at that level, piling up in the body. And they made a prediction based on all their experience as to which of these 60 are going to have significantly closed coronary arteries. The men then went to the radiologist, angiograms were taken, and then they tabulated the closure of the arteries against the original predictions. And out of the original 60 predictions, 59 were absolutely correct. One mistake out of 60. There's no better predictive test in the world, 98% predictive accuracy. And all they have to know is what your cholesterol level is and your triglyceride level and your age. So if anyone tells you that cholesterol level is not a good factor in predicting closure of the arteries, refer them to the Cleveland Clinic study. Now, there are many diets around the world. There's hundreds of different diets. Many diets are associated with artery closure. Many diets are not. But there are principally only two kinds of diets in our world. There's the high-fat diet of the developed nations, and then there's a very low-fat diet of the undeveloped nations. The high-fat diet has 40 to 45% of its total calories in fat, 500 to 1,000 milligrams of cholesterol, which is like eating two or three eggs a day. And the countries in the developing nations have about 10 or 15% total calories in fat in their diet, and less than 100 milligrams of cholesterol, which is about eating a pound or pound and a half of animal protein a week. Our diet here is monitored and modeled after the undeveloped nations, where heart disease is rarely found and all the other degenerative diseases are rarely found. And some people say, well, maybe your diet is deficient. Maybe that's why it should not be used. I'd like to tell you that the diet that we use meets all the federal RDA requirements, the required daily allowances, in all factors, protein, minerals, vitamins, and so on, with plenty of room to spare, so we have no concern there. So if the diet as we're advocating turns out to be a solution in all these diseases, why isn't it used? Well, probably one reason it isn't used is because the American Heart Association, that sets the style for diets in our country for heart disease, has decided 15 or more years ago that they want maximum compliance. They know that cholesterol level in excess is bad in the blood. Nobody questions anymore that high cholesterol levels will lead to closure of your arteries. The only question is, how do you lower cholesterol levels successfully? In the 1950s, the diet studies showed that if you lower cholesterol level by cutting it out of the diet, you did slow down closure of the arteries, you saved people's lives. And the same studies showed that any other way to do it just didn't work. But the American Heart Association happened to see the work of a particular investigator, Dr. Kinsella Berkeley, who noted that polyunsaturated fats lowers the cholesterol in the blood. And they said, that's a terrific idea. We won't let anyone have to change their diet and get a low-fat, low-cholesterol diet. We'll let them use exactly what they're eating all the time, change the kind of fat. And that's what they did in their 1961 recommendation, which was their first recommendations. Don't change anything. Just change the kind of fat you're having. They thought they'd get the maximum compliance that way, and they certainly did. Maximum compliance, minimum effectiveness. Because we've now had a number of American Heart Association diet trials. Oslo, London, and Wadsworth VA Hospital. The Oslo, 11-year study with 400 men. London, 6-year study, 400 men. Wadsworth, 8-year study, 846 men. Half the men on the American Heart Association diet, half on the standard American kind of diet, and yet the difference between both groups was no more than 5% death rate. Not a significant difference. It could happen by chance. Yet on the low-fat, low-cholesterol diets that were tried out in the 1950s, there was a 50% difference in death rate. Twice as many deaths on the standard American diet than the low-fat, low-cholesterol diet. So the diet approach by the American Heart Association hasn't worked in the many large-scale programs. And the latest fiasco, the Mr. Fit study, Mr. Fit means multiple risk factor intervention trial, 12,000 men are on a greatly elaborated American Heart Association trial. 6,000 men on their new and improved diet, which is like the old one, 6,000 men on the regular American diet. The study is going to cost you at least $100 million, the 6-year study. It's going on now for 2 years already, and they haven't met their goals yet, but here are their goals. Here are their 6-year goals. In 6 years, they hope to achieve a 10% reduction of cholesterol level. Now, we achieve a 10% reduction of cholesterol level in 6 days, not 6 years. And let me tell you the virtue of reducing cholesterol 10% in 6 years. If your cholesterol is 300, and you reduce it 10% to 270, the Framingham study tells us that you still have 400% greater risk of heart death than if you're down to 220. So what's the point of bringing it down to 270? Yet that'll satisfy the American Heart Association and the National Institute of Health that's doing the study. The study obviously is going to fail because it's another one of these studies where they're trying to use a dietary program that is no change from what you're normally eating, just give you a change in the kind of fat. How about drugs? The big coronary drug project, which is a 5-year double-blind study, 8,300 men. They used the best drugs they had. They used niacin, the vitamin. They used Atrmetes. They used estrogens. They used thyroid. And they used placebo. Placebo is that empty capsule with no drug effect. At the end of the 5-year study, it was a marvelous study. It cost you over $40 million, but it was the best dollar you ever spent. Because at the end of the study, there was only one capsule that proved to be the most effective. The least amount of side effects, the least amount of problems, and that was placebo. So it cost you $41 million to find out that there isn't a drug that we have that can help your heart disease. Even though all the other drugs lowered cholesterol level, they didn't reduce the death rate. And we all know about surgery, coronary bypass surgery, very popular, probably 100,000 cases next year will be operated on. But we also know that 20% of all bypasses close in the first 12 months. So you're not going to get very far with conventional medical care on coronary heart disease. Unless you go right to the cause, which is the diet, the high cholesterol, high fat American diet, there is no hope to make any progress. Now, how about the other degenerative diseases? And I should mention that before we go into the others, that we do know there is hope for changing the situation. We do know about the human studies and the primate studies that show if you lower the fat and cholesterol sufficiently, you can have reversal of artery closure. There's 4 human studies so far reported in the last 2 years, and many, many primate studies, Dr. Whistler, University of Chicago Medical School, Dr. Mark Armstrong, University of Iowa Medical School. And the reversal of artery closure all has been accomplished by taking the cholesterol and fat out of the diet. The cholesterol is a principal factor. The fat is a secondary factor. The problem of diet with other factors such as sight and hearing. Hearing, we know, is related to the amount of oxygen that reaches the hearing organ. And if you're a smoker, you can detect in a few weeks a loss of high-frequency hearing. If you stop smoking, you can gain a certain amount of your high-frequency hearing. On the other hand, if you're on a high-fat, high-cholesterol diet and you close up the vessel that feeds the ear, you gradually lose your high-frequency tones. And it's so predictable that in our country, we can predict, an expert can, your age within 5 years by taking a hearing test and seeing how much of your high-frequency tones have been lost. So hearing is not an inevitable loss. It has to occur with aging. We know in countries on low-fat, low-cholesterol diets that their hearing lasts 40 years longer than they do in our country without loss. So we know how to handle that. And we know there are many cases where some hearing is restored when the diet is changed. How about glaucoma? Glaucoma is a disease, a problem only of Western countries. In countries on low-fat, low-cholesterol diets, glaucoma is never found. It's rarely found, unless it's a very acute disease state. But glaucoma is normally never found. That's a problem with high-fat American diets, too. So our principal problems of loss of sight, glaucoma, cataract, sudden blindness, these are all dietary related. In fact, the diabetic problem, we call it diabetic retinopathy, the disease of the retina, if you're diabetic, is responsible for the major amount of blindness in our country. I believe 17% of all new blindnesses are from diabetics. So we certainly have to give some thought to the problem of sight. Even though we feel that the hearing loss and others are related to age, we begin to realize that that's not really true. Gallstone problems are considered something you joke about, but gallstones are no fun if you have them. They're probably the most intense kind of pain you can have, and they're considered relatively minor, but there's 300,000 operations a year to take your gallbladder out, and 6,000 people die from these operations. Yet we find that gallstones are almost completely avoidable by changing diet. The gallstone starts because cholesterol crystallizes in the gallbladder. the bile in your gallbladder gets to have a cholesterol level of 600 to 900 if your cholesterol level in your blood is 250 or so. Cholesterol in the gallbladder is three times as high as it is in the blood. When it gets to be 600 to 900, it's so concentrated, it almost has to crystallize. And once you form one crystal, another will form, and the two crystals stick together, they'll join with a third, and now you have the making of a small gallstone. Because the gallstones in the American countries are cholesterol gallstones, and they just roll together like a snowball, and that's the way you grow them. In tests on humans, we find that if you take the cholesterol out of the diet, the crystals in the gallbladder dissolve and disappear. And if you restore the cholesterol to the diet, it just takes 2 or 3 weeks before the crystals come back. So gallstones have been a mystery for many years. It's no longer a mystery because gallstones can be avoided. They never have to happen. And although we don't consider it a matter of life and death, it's certainly not the kind of thing we would like to have. Arthritis is a nuisance. It doesn't kill anybody to speak about, but it certainly makes you unhappy for many years. And we know there's different kinds of arthritis. There's gouty arthritis, when you have too much uric acid in your blood. And we know that too much uric acid comes from eating animal products. It's the only way just about you can get it. And if you have too much uric acid, it can turn into crystals, and the crystals can be eaten then by your white blood cells. The white blood cells die in the process because they can't digest the uric acid crystal. And when they die in the process, the little stomachs of the white blood cells explode. All the powerful digestive juices come out of these little stomachs right into your joint spaces, and they just irritate your joints, digest your joints, corrode your joint spacings, and the pain is, of course, tremendous. Gouty arthritis is practically 100% reversible when you lower the uric acid level in your blood by lowering the animal protein content of your diet. Rheumatoid arthritis is a little different. But all of the arthritises that are commonly known, rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis, are all problems where the digestive juices of your white blood cells, your own white blood cells, get into the joint spaces and start to digest your joint linings. It's a tragedy that we create a condition in your body that destroys your own white blood cell, which is your first line of defense, and by their destruction, the juices come out, the little digestive juices come out, and destroy your own joint tissue. That's real suicide. The way it happens with rheumatoid arthritis is that the low oxygen levels that we find in the joint spaces, because on the American diets, low oxygen levels are created, as you know, by a high-fat diet, the red blood cells stick together so they can't pick up oxygen, or by smoking. But either way you do it, if the oxygen levels get low enough, these white blood cells have their little stomachs enlarged and enlarged until they burst like a balloon. Their digestive juices spill out, get into your joint space, cause you the rheumatoid arthritis. Osteoarthritis is very similar. The little white blood cells burst again because the oxygen gets low, and when they burst and the digestive juices get out, the little cartilage cells, the ones that make your cartilage in your joints, that's your joint lining, the cartilage cells sort of go crazy, and they produce, instead of nice, flexible cartilage to line your joints, they produce a stone-like, bone-like cartilage. And only when the juices, digestive juices, go away, when you don't create new deaths of white blood cells, does your osteoarthritis stop happening. All these things happening because of your own cells reacting to lowered oxygen levels. Diabetes is a disease that goes back thousands of years. It's sort of a tragedy because it's so destructive to the body. Of every gangrenous limbs that come to the hospital to be amputated, 80% belong to diabetics. Diabetics have three times as many deaths from heart disease as non-diabetics. They have about three-quarters of all the strokes. They're number one in blindness. So it's really a tragedy to be a long-term diabetic. And yet, when we look over the history of diabetes, we found that as long as 3,000 years ago, the Egyptians knew exactly what to do with diabetes. They knew exactly what diet to put you on. They didn't understand why it worked, but it certainly did. And everything was going well until a couple hundred years ago, when the Surgeon General of England decided that since the diabetics spilled so much sugar out of the urine, the body couldn't handle carbohydrates, and so he took all the carbohydrates out of the diet. And that was probably the first high-fat, high-protein diet, and that's the way it's been ever since. And that really increased our incidence of diabetes, because that's the kind of diet that causes diabetes. And although people thought that when insulin was first developed, that was the end of diabetes, because that's going to cure it all, we discover now that over 90% of all diabetics have more insulin than they need in the body. They have much more than normal people have, 2 and 3 times as much. So we find that diabetes is not a problem of insufficient insulin. But then we have to find out, if you've got so much insulin, why are you diabetic? Why doesn't your insulin digest your sugar? Why does the sugar rise so high in the blood unhampered by anything? It isn't digested. It rises so high it spills out through the kidneys. Why does that happen? Because the insulin is insensitized. The insulin, we find, is protecting the sugar with a fat layer. When your fat rises high in your blood, it's like a barrier between the glucose, your sugar in your blood, and the insulin. And the insulin simply cannot burn up the glucose when there's too much fat in the blood. And many people have thought that diabetes is hereditary. But this whole idea has just been dispelled when we go into the studies, because Dr. Pike of England probably has the largest group of identical twin diabetics in the world in his registry. And he has followed probably 300 sets of identical twins. And he finds, after tracing many of these twins, that some twins, after they get their diabetes, the other twin is not diabetic for as much as 30 years that he's followed them. He said if there can be such a great difference in time between the time one gets diabetes and one doesn't, it cannot be a disease by heredity, or else they'd both get it within a reasonable time. And so he has been the first man to offer evidence that diabetes is not a hereditary disease. There may be some reasons to try and believe it, but if you can't have both identical twins have the diabetes, it cannot be hereditary. And we find out what is the principal reason for diabetes, because in experiments that we've done in the early 1920s, done with Dr. Rabinowitz of Canada, we know that as you lower the fat, most diabetics then have their insulin become sensitive enough so they're no longer diabetic. And 3 or 4 years ago, when we started to try our diet on various patients who had diabetes, our record was that 50% of all diabetics on insulin would get off insulin within 4 weeks. We introduced our diet to Dr. James Anderson of University of Kentucky Medical Center 3 years ago, and he gets the same results as we do. He now has had 50 diabetics through his program, and his diabetics are getting off insulin at the same rate. So that we realize that diabetes is not the problem people have thought. When Dr. Kelly M. West, who is a professor of medicine at the University of Oklahoma Medical School, said last year before the Senate hearings that if this high carbohydrate diet were used, 2/3 of all diabetics would be off all the drugs, insulin, and so on in a short time. That diabetes as a disease would disappear from our country. Dr. West is a man that's been a specialist in diabetes for many, many years, and he's a conservative physician. Well, we've had many tests for trying to help diabetics. The big university group diabetic program, where they tested the oral drugs and discovered that the oral drugs for diabetes increased the death rate from heart disease by 250% than those who did not take any drugs. And yet, when the New Jersey State of Board of Health questioned the cardiologists in New Jersey, they found that 85% of them were still using these drugs for even their heart patients who had diabetes. So you wonder what these double-blind studies teach physicians when they still continue using the drugs that are apparently creating a greater incidence of heart disease. The best and the only solution for diabetes is that you must get to the diet that creates it and control it by a proper diet. High blood pressure is one of the most widely spread diseases in our country. It's hard to believe that about 60 million people have high blood pressure. That's considering that there's only about 120 million adults in our country. 1 out of every 2 adults has high blood pressure. You have 100 people in the room, you have 50 people then who would have high blood pressure. It hardly seems possible it's such a national epidemic. Physicians used to think that high blood pressure was primarily a problem with too much salt in the diet. But when Dr. James Iacono of the U.S. Department of Agriculture did his study, he selected men and women who were on a normal American diet, 43% total calories in fat, normal amount of cholesterol, and the normal amount of salt, which was 10 grams of salt a day,
about a third of an ounce of salt a day. And he decided not to change their salt. Give them exactly the amount of salt they'd been eating, only to change their fat. He brought their fat from 43% down to 25%. And he was very careful not to change their calories. He didn't want anyone to lose weight because the first thing a physician says is lose weight, cut down salt, your high blood pressure will go away. 10 days after they're on the diet, and all they did was reduce the fat from 43% to 25%, everyone's blood pressure dropped 10%. That means if your top number was 160, you'd go down to 144, practically in a normal range, from an abnormal range. And if your top number was 100, that's certainly not acceptable, it would go down to 90 in your bottom number, which could be acceptable. So the difference between normal and abnormal, in just 10 days, Dr. Iacono was able to do by not touching salt at all. No one lost weight. They all had the normal amount of salt. He kept them on that for 40 days, and the blood pressure stayed down. And one of the interesting things about the study is that he noticed that the platelets, the little cells that create clotting in the body, the sticking together, the platelets, reduced 50% when he cut the fat down just from 43% to 25%. And that made him very happy because the new evidence had just come out that diabetic retinopathy, that's the problem that diabetics have where they go blind, where the retina bleeds and so on. Diabetic retinopathy, the severity, is correlated to the amount of platelets sticking together, platelet aggregation. So if he could reduce platelet aggregation by 50%, he could probably reduce the damage to diabetics' eyes. He considered that more important than the lowering of the blood pressure. Now, of course, he only went down to 25%. You can imagine how low you can reduce the platelets sticking together down at an 8% fat diet. Well, the diabetic specialists didn't recommend, of course, reducing fat. They just gave people aspirin and other drugs to try and reduce platelet stickiness. Diet, I guess, is not an acceptable program among physicians yet. When Dr. Iacono increased the fats in the diet, all their blood pressures went back to where they were. It was one of the best studies showing that salt is a much lesser factor than fat in high blood pressure. There has been a consensus in treating high blood pressure. The National Institute of Health, the American Heart Association, American Public Health Institute, everybody has agreed that there's one way to treat high blood pressure, and that is drug therapy for the rest of your life. Stepped up drug therapy. You start with a single drug. If that doesn't work, there are two drugs. Then you go to three drugs. Then you go to four drugs. Then you go to potassium supplements. It's all worked out. Every physician now gets a copy on how to treat high blood pressure according to the consensus. Yet, how much is talked about in the consensus booklet about diet and so on? They do say that you could ask your patient to cut down his salt intake and he could lose weight. Otherwise, nothing is talked about diet. The idea is drug therapy. Now, how effective is drug therapy? First of all, drug therapy for hypertension does not cure hypertension. It doesn't affect the disease in any way. It just paralyzes the body's ability to raise pressure. So one thing that happens is that as you paralyze the body's ability to raise pressure, your blood flow drops. And people have to have a certain minimum amount of blood flow to have normal function. So one of the side effects of hypertension drugs, as they lower blood pressure and lower blood flow, is sexual impotency. In a study done on men taking the drugs for 2 years, 50% lost their sexual potency, because without blood flow, you don't have erections. How about uric acid level? The hypertensive drugs artificially force uric acid levels up. Another study, 50% of the men had uric acid levels raised into the gout range. And so they had to then take drugs to lower uric acid level. Well, they took drugs to lower uric acid level, and the principal drugs are Zilprim, Benamid, and they created certain kinds of crystals that dig into the muscles and tear the little muscle fibers. Unfortunately, there's no drug to take against that. So that we can't cure drugs with drugs. The side effects are many. Other problems from hypertensive drugs, it can force you into diabetes. The drugs can force you, on occasion, into kidney failure. Now, all these drugs would be acceptable if there was no other way to go. But yet, our data and our first 900 patients indicate that of all the hypertensives that have come in, and there's over 200 that were diagnosed hypertensive by their physicians, that have been hypertensive for at least a year on medication, they came in with medication. In the 4 weeks' time, 85% were off their medication with normal blood pressures. Now, even if the 85% wouldn't hold, what if it's only 50%? What if it's only 25%? 25% out of 60 million means that 15 million people will never have to be on drug medication for the rest of their lives if they change their diet. So there certainly is a choice for hypertension. Now, one of the dreaded diseases, probably the most dreaded diseases, is cancer. And there are many kinds of cancers. There might be 75 kinds of cancers. But the principal cancers that kill us in these countries are lung cancer, which is number one, probably 70,000 people a year. But lung cancer is something that's sort of a predestined suicide. It's a form of suicide that you do voluntarily. So we don't take that too seriously. But we have colon cancer. That's about 40,000 deaths a year or so. We have breast cancer. These are the important cause of cancer. And altogether, cancer probably kills 300,000 people a year, about 16% of all deaths. It used to be thought that cancers are caused by viruses. And because of that, our government has spent for research probably $50 to $100 million a year for 20 years looking for the virus that causes these cancers. They've never found it. And now we're finding out that they may never find it, because we're finding the cause of these cancers seem to be foods that you eat. Colon cancer, for example, we find that in a high-fat diet, that a certain kind of bacteria grow in your large intestine. In your last 4 feet of tubing, we call it your large intestine, you have bacteria, little one-cell animals that grow. They've been there all your life. And on the high-fat diet, a certain kind grow there called anaerobic bacteria. They live without oxygen. They're nasty bacteria because when they eat your bile that comes out of your intestinal tract, they converted their excretion products to a cancer-producing substance called deoxycholic acid. They also convert it to estrogens like female hormones. And Dr. Dennis Burkitt, one of the investigators in colon cancer, feels very strongly that the site where all of this deoxycholic acid, this poisonous excretion products from your bacteria when they eat your bile, that the excretion products are right at the points where colon cancer is formed. That's where the colon cancer is formed. In countries that are on low-fat, low-cholesterol diets, these bacteria cannot live in your colon. It's not a favorable atmosphere. Instead, you have a different kind of bacteria that are favorable for you. They're called aerobic. They live with oxygen. And they cannot excrete this deoxycholic acid. They can't make it from bile. And they don't get the estrogens out as the other ones do. And therefore, colon cancer is rarely found, if ever. Dr. Burkitt said that in the hospitals he served in Africa, for 25 years, thousands of black people, he never saw one case of colon cancer. His first case of colon cancer came from a white man. So colon cancer turns out to be not a virus, not a pesticide, but just from your ordinary high-fat diet. And then we have lung cancer. Now, lung cancer, we realize, has to be initiated by cigarettes, or could be initiated by asbestos powder. It could be initiated by other dust. But cigarettes are a principal cause of lung cancer. But the surprising part that we find is that if you're not on a high cholesterol diet, your incidence of lung cancer may not be very much. Because we find in just the last short period of time that cholesterol has something to do with lung cancer. And that's a brand new finding. Because 10 or so years ago, when Dr. Jeremiah Stamler of the Chicago Board of Health tested his people from the People's Gas Company, he found that he couldn't figure out a relationship between the amount of cigarettes people smoked and lung cancer. But he did find a relationship between their cholesterol and lung cancer. If their cholesterol level was 275 or more, there were 7 or 8 times as many cases of lung cancer than if the cholesterol level was 220 or less. What does cholesterol level have to do with lung cancer? He didn't know, and neither did anyone else know. But there were 900 people in the study. It was a good scientific study, and there's no question that the lung cancer incidence was absolutely related and correlated to cholesterol level. If the cholesterol level went down below 150, you wouldn't find any lung cancer. Well, we learned about a year or two ago as to why this happened, because we find that high cholesterol blood paralyzes the white blood cell that eats cancer cells, the big macrophage, that big cell that could be almost 50 times larger than a red blood cell. It's an immense cell. It goes around through the tissues, in and out of the blood vessels, looking for things to eat that don't belong there, and it eats cancer cells. And that's why we realize now that high cholesterol blood, if it paralyzes these, that all you need is high cholesterol blood when you have cancer cells starting in the lung, and it just runs rampant, and you'll develop lung cancer. If you don't have high cholesterol levels, apparently then the incidence of lung cancer is far, far less. And now we can understand more that in countries like Vilcabamba, Ecuador, and Soviet Georgia, where we see people 95 years old smoking, we can realize they must have low cholesterol levels, or they wouldn't be alive. We find out other things about cancer. For example, we find that the problem of breast cancer, which is the leading cause of death for women 35 to 55 years old. Why is the breast cancer so prevalent and only on countries on the Western diet? And on countries on the low-fat, low-cholesterol diet, breast cancer is practically unknown. Is it something hereditary only due to people who live in our kinds of countries? No, because we know that if Japanese women have a very low rate of breast cancer, move to Hawaii or United States, the same sisters in the same family will develop breast cancer, whereas the other sisters in Japan are perfectly all right. Through a long series of investigations, we seem to find a relationship between the fat in the diet and breast cancer. And now one of the suspected causes are these anaerobic bacteria, the ones that only can grow on a high-fat diet, because they give off an estrogen. And the estrogens reabsorb back in your body. Normally, we wouldn't worry about it, because so what if you reabsorb some estrogen back in your body? Let me tell you the effect of estrogens in the body that the body doesn't make. A 3.5-year-old girl used her mother's estrogen face cream, rubbed it all over her body for a couple months, and the reason they discovered she was doing it is because her breasts started to grow. They took her to a physician, and he examined her and found that her uterus looked like a normal adult female menstruating uterus at 3.5 years old. And yet she absorbed just a tiny amount of estrogen, 1/20th of the minimum low amount that you normally would have to have. How about the Planned Parenthood statistics? Women taking oral contraceptives, another estrogen, if they take it for 6 months, those who started were completely cyst-free in the uterus. After 6 months, 25% of the women now have cysts in the uterus. After 2 years, 80% have cysts in the uterus from the oral contraceptives, estrogens. And we know that if you have uterine cysts, there's a 260% greater incidence of breast cancer. So we certainly can see that there's an influence on the oral contraceptives and breast cancer. Women that took diethylstibesterol for controlling miscarriages, after a period of years, we find their breast cancer rate has increased over those who did not take it. Estrogens are a problem. And how about Premarin? Premarin is the estrogen taken to keep women young forever. If you've taken Premarin for 2 years or more, you get 400% greater incidence of cancer of the uterus. If you take it for 7 years or more, the incidence is 14 to 1. 1,400% more cancer of the uterus if you're taking Premarin than if you've never taken it. Estrogens stimulate the sex organs. They stimulate the uterus, the breasts, the ovaries, and that's why it's thought that estrogens are a potent force. And we know that by the age of menstruation. Why is it that girls now have their first menstruation at 10, 11, 12 years old, when for millions of years, developing the human race, their menstruation always happens 16, 17, 18, 19 years old? Why suddenly 10, 11 years old? Has man's heredity changed in the last 50, 75 years? No, it's because large groups have suddenly taken up the high-fat, high-cholesterol diet in the last 50, 75 years. They call that an elevation of your standard of living. Now we realize that in these populations, that the high-fat diet that creates the anaerobic bacteria that create the estrogens to go right back through the bowel into the system from the time they're a year old, these estrogens from the time they're a year old stimulate the ovaries, the uterus, and the breast so much that they start to menstruate when they're 10, 11 years old. This tremendous stimulation by the estrogens all your life, I would many investigators feel, stimulates the breast cancer and the ovaries, ovarian cancer and uterine cancer. Because in countries on low-fat diets with the right kind of bacteria, these cancers don't exist. So we begin to see a tremendous amount of problems due to diet that heretofore were thought to relate to other things. Even the polyunsaturated fats, we know they increase gallstone formation 3 times as many. But the idea that they increase cancer rate is a brand new finding. We find out on an animals, the polyunsaturated fats will double the incidence of colon cancer than any other kind of fat, lard and so on. So that not only does it do a disservice for us for creating more gallstones, blocking the vessels in the eyes and the rest of the body, it's even related in cancer. Perhaps the finding of the Wadsworth VA study with the 846 men that there were 50% more cancer deaths among the polyunsaturated American Heart Association group than the other group might not be an accidental finding. Perhaps it has some element of truth in it, because certainly we find it with animal studies. When you look at all these diseases, you see them as unrelated. But I like to tell you that they're all related. And we've coined a term called lipotoxemia. Lipo means lipid, means fat. Toxemia means poisoning of the blood, a fat poisoning of the blood. For example, if you have arsenic poisoning, if it's a habit in our country to sprinkle some white arsenic powder in your salad every night because it tastes sweet, you're going to develop loosening of the teeth and falling hair. So you go to your dentist and say, I've got loosening of the teeth. Nobody worries about the arsenic that you're eating. And so the dentist makes elaborate structures to keep your teeth from falling apart. He strings them together with pieces of wire, clamps them to your gums, does all kinds of things, and you think that's fine. You go to your barber for a wig, for a hair transplant. Nobody's concerned that the problem is not to your barber, it's not your dentist. It's arsenic poisoning. You stop eating the arsenic, suddenly your teeth tighten, your hair grows back. That's what these diseases are. Lipotoxemia, poisoning of the blood from fat and cholesterol. And the side effects, the symptoms are artery closure, diabetes, gallstones, cataract, glaucoma, high blood pressure, arthritis, the many diseases, as we call the degenerative diseases. That's why these diseases are not natural to man. They're an environmental poisoning. They're poisoning from what you put in your own mouth by foods that are unnatural to man. And that's why one diet can reverse and prevent these many, many diseases. You wonder, how is it possible one diet can do it all? Because these are all symptoms of a single kind of poisoning, an environmental poisoning. We call it lipotoxemia, and we hope that when you go back, you'll be able to carry the message that a simple dietary approach can handle diseases unnatural to man. And what is that dietary approach? Simply, we recommend whole grains, oats, wheat, corn, rice, and so on, brown rice. We recommend fruits and vegetables. We recommend beans or peas for variety, tubers, potatoes, and so on. And we also recommend that you don't have over 1.5 pounds of animal protein a week at any time. For growing children, for young adults, that's your limit. For those who have severe artery closure, as you know, we don't recommend animal protein for a 6-month or 12-month period, except in very tiny quantities, a few ounces a week. So the diet then turns out to be relatively simple. And we feel it's a diet that at least could make you have the opportunity that when you die, you're going to die of old age rather than degenerative diseases. Thank you.